Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine.
Yes, welcome indeed. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. Good guest this week, Matt Myra, is with me. Now, Matt is the host of the CBS All Access After Star Trek show. He has also been the host of the Nerdist podcast for like 10 years. He's actually involved with like 20 podcasts. I don't know how he does it, one of which is with Kevin Smith, and that's how I first got to know him when I was a guest with Kevin Smith. And in addition to all of that, he is a writer on staff of the Goldbergs on ABC. The man is fast becoming a media legend. I was able to catch up with him between writing a script, flying to New York, trying to have a baby, and I think performing brain surgery. It's really a very fascinating interview. He talks about breaking into the business, which he does in a very unusual way. Talks about his various projects, Star Trek, obviously, the Goldbergs, obviously, commuting to New York from LA every single week. Also has some tips for navigating this new multi-platform landscape that we find ourselves in. Okay, so you're going to enjoy it. Matt Myra, this week on
Hollywood and Levine.
Okay, so the first thing I got to ask you about is Kevin Smith and how he's doing these days after that heart attack.
Well, Ken, I'm happy to report Kevin is probably the healthiest Kevin I've ever known now.
Oh, yeah.
He's lost, it's probably 42 pounds by now.
And we're talking just a few months.
Oh, we're talking a little over two months.
Wow.
It's remarkable. I saw him, he was supposed to direct the finale of the Goldbergs. So we saw him on Friday for the table read.
Right.
And we were supposed to shoot on Monday.
Oh, wow.
And Sunday.
It was that week.
And it was Sunday night that I got a text from our showrunner asking about Kevin. And I said, what are you talking about? And he's like, something happened to Kev. I'm not sure exactly what, but I don't know. I don't think he's going to be directing the show this week. So I then went to Twitter, as you do, for news. Doesn't matter.
I go to Instagram, but okay.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how close you are with an individual.
Yeah.
Go to Twitter. And I went and did a scan of Kevin's name, and I saw a few tweets of people that had been there at the show in Glendale for his stand-up special taping, saying something about him having being taken away in an ambulance. So I do a little more reading, and I find out that, oh, man, Kevin's had a heart attack. So I text our friend, mutual friend Scott Mosier, who, you know, Kevin and Scott came up together. They did Clerks.
He produced, he's produced everything.
And Scott's in Paris, so I knew that his timeline was a little different than mine. So I was like, hey, I just heard this thing about Kevin.
Kevin had a heart attack, but enjoy your trip.
I don't know how. Yeah. He's living there now. So he's really having a time, that Scott. But I also texted Kevin, and it went through and it said delivered. So I was like, okay, his phone's on. He's probably
he's not dead. If his
I feel
phone
like when you die,
working.
Your phone turns off.
Right.
I heard from Kevin the next morning. And it was just like a very funny text. It sounded like Kevin. And we then I saw him about a week later. We went and did a podcast, and I was just, he just so joyful. He was just grateful.
Sure, yeah. I mean, and, you know, like playing with house money now.
Yeah. And
how did he have to change his life? Did he have to change his diet?
Yes.
More exercise?
Yeah.
He's able to do that?
Yes and yes. So, like, in the old days, they'd have to slice you open right down the middle.
Yeah. And you'd be in the hospital for
weeks. Mm-hmm. And now, through the wonders of surgical advancements and technology, they can just pull an artery and stent you and do everything without having to open you up.
It's a Tommy John.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's the recovery is even much faster than Tommy John is now. I'm telling you. He was out of the hospital in 2 days.
Amazing.
And felt like $1 million because the blood
probably
was
felt better.
Yes,
yeah.
He did.
Yeah.
Because the blood was pumping through. And as his doctor said to him, and he relayed to me, it's called the Widowmaker for a reason, and nowadays people just feel like they can do anything. And in the old days, people would have to be in a hospital recovering, so it would really shock their system and they would change.
Sure.
So
yeah.
His advice to Kevin was, lose this weight, we need you to get healthier, and he's done it. He's doing it. He's doing a great job.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Way to go, Kev.
Okay. So let's talk about you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have done so many different things with your podcasts, TV things, writing. What did you want to be when you came out here?
Did
you want to be a writer, or did you want to be Conan O'Brien to be the writer who then became the performer?
That's an excellent question. I always wanted to be a writer. I came out here, I remember my mother asking me what I wanted to do, and me telling her, I want to be a comedy writer. I would like to convert to Judaism. This is what I said to her when I was 10 years old, because I had seen your show of shows writers panel special on PBS.
Uh-huh.
And it was Sid Caesar, Mel Brooks, Carl Reiner, Woody Allen. And I was just
Larry Gelbart,
yeah,
everybody.
I was just like, oh, the through line here. I was just trying to piece it together. I was like, the through line here is they're all Jewish. So, Mom, I'd like to be a comedy writer. I need to be Jewish. Please, can I convert? You know, this is coming from a Catholic kid outside of Boston. My mother...
How did she react
to
that?
She surprisingly humored me. And she had gotten me a book, which was Judaism for Dummies. Like, there was a Judaism for Dummies book. And she said, here, you know, if you're serious about this, read this and tell me what you think. So I start going through it, and I'm just like, oh, this is... They only have the first half of the Bible. I went to Catholic school as a kid too, which was also entertaining. But I read it and I just became so lazy with the idea. I was like, maybe I don't need to actually be Jewish and just sort of figure it out. I think we all have the same guilt.
Eat at delis.
I think we have. Yeah. I think we, the Catholics and the Jews, share a lot of guilt.
Well, you got the guilt. You got that part down.
100%. So it just sort of went by the wayside, and I decided to figure out how to become a writer without having to convert. when I was in college, this was in the early aughts, it's like 2001, 2002, I decided that I wanted to be a showrunner. Like, I was like, oh, what I want to do is I want to be a showrunner. I want to run a show. And I would tell my professor this, and he would be very confused because it was a film school. And everyone's trying to write screenplays. And I just was like, how about instead of a screenplay, I write a television
script? They looked down on you for wanting to do comedy?
They were confused by the whole situation.
Yeah that's what I got. Because, usually film school, everything has to be important, and you go, well, I want to be Rob Petrie, and they all want to be Kurosawa.
to be Rob Petrie, I always wonder what his commute was. I know there was that episode where he lost the script on the train. So I'm guessing he took a train most of the time into the city.
Right.
Right. But I always wanted...
You know, you can't go to New Rochelle and get on a train and do that.
I know, but I always thought he dropped... I always wondered that as a kid.
Not like the Jetsons.
How does he get into the city? How does he do that? But, yeah, I wanted to be a showrunner. And my instructor, my professor, he was like, okay, if you want to write a script, I have to figure out what that format is. So do you have any that I can read? And I was like, yeah, here's... what did I give him? I think I gave him a Scrubs.
Okay.
Maybe the Ricky Gervais Office.
Okay.
And some other script I had downloaded off of the early internet. And he read them and was like, okay, well, they need to be about this length and give me something. What do you got? So I wrote a Scrubs. Like, that was
okay.
That's what I did.
You know,
I was like, I'm going to write a Scrubs.
Not like you wrote a Webster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wrote an episode of Scrubs that I have only the cold open of at my house. I don't know where the rest of the script went.
Uh-huh.
But he seemed to enjoy it enough to pass me. I got an A. And I felt like I'd really pulled something over on everybody because I only had to write 37 pages.
They had to write 120.
Jokes on them. Yeah. And then I sort of was like, okay, so now what do I do? I'll move to LA. That's the plan.
Uh-huh.
And I went. I just packed up and was like, I'm good.
So how did you break in?
Well, it's a weird twisted tale that involves the Apple Store. I moved to LA without a job. I had spent 4 years previously in school and working at a funeral home. So that was enjoyable. But when I decided to move to LA, I said, oh, I'll get a job at a Starbucks or an Apple Store because those are the two places that offer health insurance for part-time people.
You bet.
And they're also places that I know, you know, people need them. So, you know, maybe someone comes in
right.
who I can befriend.
Uh-huh.
that was my plan. I didn't know it would work so well. So I went and got a job at the Grove at the Apple Store.
Okay.
And that is where I met Chris Hardwick. And that is where I met Jimmy Dore and Todd Glass, who were two great comedians. So I came out here, started working at the Apple Store as a Mac genius. Started doing open mics. I was like, I have to do something.
Okay, so you're a stand-up, too.
I gotta keep the brain going, so I'll do stand-up. So I started doing open mics. I would go to the UCB constantly, just absorb any comedy I could. I think the first year I was in LA, I went to 60-something UCB shows.
Okay.
And started to befriend everybody, and then I became known as like, oh, he can hold a conversation, and he's a Mac genius, so let's go visit Matt. Whenever we need a iPod fixed or a laptop battery replaced. So everyone did. And it was about a year.
And you can update my Adobe while you're here.
Yeah, totally. And it was about a year or so into working at the Apple Store that I started doing podcasts. It was in 2008. I started producing a podcast for Jimmy Dore and Todd Glass called Comedy and Everything Else.
Okay.
We did 88 episodes of that. And that podcast was great. We would have people like Jim Gaffigan or Norm Macdonald on, Paul F. Tompkins, just all these like great, hilarious people.
Really the early days of podcasting.
Yeah.
You were pioneers.
We did it. We were there in the O's. and it was about 2 years into doing that that Chris Hardwick said, you know, would you be interested in producing and being on the microphone on The Nerdist? I want to start this podcast called The Nerdist. And I said, absolutely. And I did. And we started that podcast, and it was immediately more successful than it deserved to be. You know, so many, like, downloads I still haven't been able to touch on my other podcasts.
Hey, I was on there once.
And, you know, we did that podcast, and I worked at the Apple Store still. And we wound up doing a pilot of that podcast for BBC America in 2011 or 12.
Were you continuing to write during this period? Were you still writing specs and things?
Yeah, I was trying to sort of... There's a danger. You sort of get away from your first... You get away from your goal. You get busy with other things.
Right.
So I found that I felt like I was being fulfilled comedy-wise by doing these podcasts and doing stand-up. So I just sort of dropped the writing. It just sort of went by the wayside.
Okay.
And then when BBC America said we'd like to do a show of the Nerdist television show, I was like, oh, okay, I can handle this. And I went in and met with one writer, Kristen Rutherford, who's fantastic, and she and I essentially wrote that first episode because Hardwick was too busy and Jonah was busy. I think Jonah was working on Talk Soup or something at that point.
Okay.
So he was busy with a day job, and I was like, well, I'll just take a week or two off from the Apple store and write a pilot. Which I did, and it went on the air. So from there, it aired. I was still at the Apple store, and it started to get weird at the Apple store where people were coming in who were fans of the podcast.
Okay, and they recognize you.
Exactly. So there just was this sort of disconnect in my brain of like, why am I still fixing computers when people are coming in and they know me?
Meryl Streep, what are you doing here at the Cheesecake Factory as my waitress?
Well, I started here, so yeah. I just
thought. Andy Kaufman. Andy Kaufman, even when he was on Taxi on Tuesday nights, every Tuesday night, was a busboy at Jerry's Deli in the Valley.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. All through Taxi and all through the halcyon days of his career, on Tuesday nights, you know, you would see him with the bucket going up and clearing tables. Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Did he start? Had he started there and just didn't want to quit? Was that sort of it? Or was it just a Kaufman thing?
It's Andy Kaufman.
It was a Kaufman thing. Yeah. No one can explain.
I have no idea.
No one can explain.
Yeah.
But the sort of the straw that broke the camel's back, or sort of like that pushed me out the door at Apple, I was downstairs going into the break room, and a guy was there with pushing a child in a carriage, and his wife was there, and he saw me going into the back. He was waiting for the elevator to go upstairs. There's two floors at the Grove Apple store, and he saw me, eyes went wide, and he asked if we could take a photo. And he handed me his baby. So I'm sitting there in my Mac Genius thing with a lanyard, and where I'm holding this guy's baby, and we take a picture together. His wife takes the picture, and I say, thank you. That's that. And I go in, and there was one of my coworkers was there, saw the whole thing, and was like, he's like, this is crazy. What are you doing? What are you doing? And it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't every day, certainly, but, it, you know, the people that come, that know you from podcasts, they feel like they really know you because you're in their head.
You're in their heads, and podcasts tend to be pretty revealing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you have that podcast, you and your wife,
yeah.
The Excellent Adventure,
yeah.
Talking about fertility,
yeah.
And, you know, having a bit. How's that going?
It's going great, Ken. We're about to do round 5. Yeah, my wife and I have been going through IVF for, oh God. I mean, since we've been married, like we don't know marriage without infertility.
Uh-huh.
It's been a long, crazy process. There've been a lot of ups and downs, and they're all available to listen to on iTunes. It's been great because there's been a lot of people reaching out to us. No one was talking about it. Everyone was like keeping it sort of like to themselves, not even telling their family members they're going through it. There was some sort of stigmatism of it being embarrassing that sort of broke when I talked about it on the Nerdist podcast. We did a live show in San Diego, and I talked about my sperm being dumb and like me thinking I had great sperm when my doctor told me I had 1 million. That was my count.
Uh-huh.
I was like, this is amazing. I have 1 million. I don't have 1 million of anything. And he's like, well, normal sperm count's 80 to 120 million. I was like, oh.
If you would have converted, okay? I'm just saying.
I ended up marrying a Jew, so she's really helping me out here.
Okay, Passover's you should be now. Up to 2 million.
But it was when I told that story on the podcast that people started reaching out, going like, "I'm so glad you're talking about this. No one ever talks about this." And my wife said, "Hey, we should do this as a podcast." And I said, "That's ridiculous. No one wants to hear that." And she's like, "No, I think we should do it." I was like, "I'll put out a Twitter poll. And if it's over 60%, then I'll do it." And I put out the poll, and it was like 83% of the people that follow me wanted me to do this podcast with my wife. So I blame them.
Wow, yeah.
For all of this.
Now, do you ever say anything, or does she ever say anything on the podcast where you go, "Ooh, gee, honey." you know, that's kind of between you and me, isn't it?
It's funny you say that. We have a lot of those moments, but we always leave them in.
Uh-huh.
We're like brutally honest on that podcast,
which is probably the attraction.
Yeah, but it's the way to go too, because it's like everyone who's going through IVF, it is such a grind. It really is a grind, and we're now into our fifth round, and it's like, you know, not only is it like 25-30 grand a pop out of pocket, because, you know, you can't find medical insurance that covers infertility, right, in California.
Right. Don't you kind of make that money on the Blue Apron commercials, though?
HelloFresh, use the promo code EXCELLENT.
Yeah.
You know, it's so funny. The advertising that we do on that podcast, it essentially just, like, sort of keeps the lights on the podcast, and then you're just like, oh, my God, this is so... I can't imagine a world where I don't have good credit and can't keep pushing balances left and right on 0% uh-huh. balance offers. Like, uh-huh. I don't know how we would afford this if we weren't both with great credit just pushing 0% balance offers left and right. It's insane. It's brutal. And but we're honest about it, and I think that's what people like about it. And we've heard from so many thousands of people that just...
You're providing a service.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you really are. So how'd you get the Goldbergs? How'd you become a writer on the Goldbergs?
The Goldbergs is...
Again, if you would have converted...
I know.
You would be showrunning it by now.
I would have been there season one instead of getting on season four.
Exactly. I guess we need to have one Shagets on the on the staff.
The Goldbergs, interestingly enough, Adam F. Goldberg, the showrunner of the Goldbergs, it's his life, it's his family. That's the story we're telling over there. It's a Jewish family in the 80s in the greater Philadelphia area.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me later on that he listened to the Nerdist podcast, and he would come into the Apple store.
Oh,
and
wow.
And he would be nervous when I would be there fixing his computer.
Uh-huh.
And to this day in the writer's room, I would say once a month, he does an impression of me at the Apple store for the whole room, which is just... It is me just putting my hand up to him and going like, "Let me see it," and just grabbing his computer and not even saying anything and just turning it back around and going like, "Here you go," like just not even acknowledging him as a person. But the Goldbergs came about. I had it was after I was on At Midnight on Comedy Central for a long time, like 2.5 years of that show. So that's, I don't know how many episodes we did. I did 200 and some
right.
odd episodes of that show.
With Chris.
It was on 4 days. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was on 4 days a week on Comedy Central. And it just became such a repetitive act to me, these jokes. I was like, it's the same structure. It's the same grind. It's how many hashtags can I come up with? You know, like make a movie dumb or something like that. And then it's like, oh, well, how would you do that? Well, all right. Then you have to come up with examples of that. And we would have written, for every show that we did, we would have about 10 pages of jokes.
Wow.
That the comedians could pick from
if
they
okay.
wanted to.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So if they wanted it, they're there. This is how the joke works. This is the joke structure you should have. Also, if you'd like to use any of these, go for it. And a lot of them, I would say, All the guys and gals that would win all the time and were great at the show,
right?
They would write their own. I will say, like, so, like Ron Funches and like Doug Benson and Nikki Glaser, like all of those people would just.
I would probably do the same thing.
Yeah, I would too.
Write
I would
my
be,
own stuff.
I'd be like, no, I'm gonna write my own stuff. But you know, there were a lot of people that would pick, and a lot of people that would just use it as a jumping off point,
right?
But we'd have 10 pages of those every day, and I was like, 200 episodes into it, I'm like. I've been around for 2,000 pages of jokes. 2,000 pages of the same jokes. Like, I cannot do this anymore.
5% of which have been used.
It's, yeah. And you, I would just go, okay. And it would just start to weigh on me, and I would just, it would grind me down. My wife would be like, why are you so miserable every time you come home? And I'd be like, I don't know. I had to do a 9,000th joke about BuzzFeed today. Like, I just can't do this anymore. And she's like, just take a cycle off. So, you know, in the late night world, you're on 12-week contracts, 12-week cycles. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, maybe I should do that. She's like, do it. You'll be happier. I'll be happier. I was like, okay. So I take a cycle off from At Midnight, and then I get the email 12 weeks later. It's like, hey, you going to come back? And I go, no. I'm getting married. I don't, you know, it's like going to be a whole thing. I'd have to take 2 weeks off. I can't come back. So as soon as I say no, I then start panicking. I'm like, I'm a writer who just turned down writing work, like steady television writing work. What is wrong with me?
Right.
So that's when I started therapy. And that's also when I started to crack down and start going like, I want to get into scripted. Why am I not writing scripts? Then I started writing and writing and writing. And it was my wife who said, why don't you email Adam Goldberg and just tell him that you want to do something in scripted? And sort of like, just, and I was like, okay, it's a reasonable idea. And I remember emailing Adam in like December of whatever year The Force Awakens came out. That's how I remember things.
I remember things by World Series champions. So I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
The reason I remember it is he had done an episode of the Nerdist podcast, and he and I had really hit it off. And it was during an off cycle. I was just not on At Midnight, and I just went to this podcast. And I was like, I'll just go to this one, whatever. And we hit it off, and he's like, oh, here, he's like, anytime you have anything for me to read, please send it my way. Let's exchange emails. So we do. And every so often we would touch base about some nerdy thing. And then when my wife said, reach out to Adam, because I always hated being the guy who was asking, like putting out feelers. I always hated that. To my detriment, I think, in my career, I just have never wanted to bother anyone. I'm always like, maybe, I don't know. But it was when Dory, my wife, said to me, she's like, email Adam. Just email Adam. Just do it. Just tell him you wrote the script and send it to him if he wants it. And I was like, I'll just email him. Fine. I do it. And then 45 minutes later, he emails me back. And he's like, we're working on a pilot right now. Can you pitch us some jokes on this? Here, just read this and pitch us jokes. So I'm like, oh, shoot. I was supposed to go see The Force Awakens opening night. You know what? I'll just sit down with the script and do that instead. It was one of those moments where
it's not a Broadway play,
yeah,
you
it's
know?
Not going away.
It'll be there again in 4 hours.
So I sit down, crack the script open, and I send him 6 pages of jokes. And I send him off, and an hour after that, he emails me back. He's like, these are all amazing. I think we're going to use everything you sent us. Do you have a spec or anything like that? And I was like, I do? Oh, this is interesting. I sure do. So I emailed him my spec, and
Scrubs?
I emailed him a spec pilot.
Okay.
About the Genius Bar.
Oh, okay. Right.
Which is right up his alley, because why not? And I sent him that, and he's like, listen, if I can figure out a spot for you, I'm going to try to figure out a spot for you. But be patient because it's the middle of the season now and so on and so forth. And so that was in December. And the season starts in May.
Mm-hmm.
So May rolls around. He's trying to get me in. He can't get me in. Then August rolls around and he somehow finds the money somewhere to bring me and Eric Weiner in together as a team. And we said, oh, all right. I talked to Eric. And,
so paper partners,
well,
essentially.
You know, we're a good, real team.
Okay.
Yeah. Eric and I, we met previous to working there, and we talked, and we hit it off, and we would see each other fairly frequently in that four-month period leading up to when we actually got in the room.
Okay.
And, you know, August rolled around, and I was at a Dodger game. I remember he, like, texts me, and I'm like, oh, wow, it's happening. So he's like, I think you're going to start Monday. And I was like, this is fantastic. Okay. So I say, honey, I can't do whatever the hell I was doing. I'm going to start over at the Goldbergs on Monday. So Eric and I start, and we've been there ever since now. We've done two seasons. We're going back for the sixth season. We're no longer a team. We've split.
Uh-huh.
It's just been a sort of like the dream was to work in a scripted room. And it's fascinating how different it works from late night. I find it so fascinating. Just the
differences. In what way?
Well, I feel like scripted writers are so much more precious about their words than a late night writer is.
Right.
And part of that, I think, is the fact that in the late night room, you're just grinding out the episodes.
Right.
You're doing four or five in a week.
Right.
And you're not working on one script for four
months.
Yeah,
you don't have a lot invested in it.
Yeah, you're just like, whatever gets us home,
right,
this is going to be great. Because if the joke isn't great, we can do a great joke tomorrow. And it's also like, in a late night room, there's a lot more, at least between at midnight and the Goldbergs, I find that there was a lot more fucking around. And a lot more ribbing of each other in the late night room than there is in the scripted room.
Yeah.
And also there's
more to do.
There's a little more to do. But there's also like the other benefit to a late night room versus benefit for how each show works. I suppose they're both beneficial to how each works. There's no real hierarchy in a late night room because you're all staff writers and there's a head writer.
Okay.
That's it. So you don't have to deal with, you know, we need a room with an EP and like then
right,
there's a
the number two guy.
Yeah. And you're just like everyone's ego. You have to deal with each ego to get something through.
Right.
And you have to navigate that, which took me, I would say, probably 3 months to really absorb and learn.
Right.
And also to shut up and just sort of like absorb what's happening and just go with the flow of the room. That's all you do. I say to people now that when they ask me, like, what's the best advice you have for someone who's starting in a writer's room? And I say, your job on a show is just to make the showrunner's life a little bit easier. If you can just make the showrunner's life a little bit easier, you're doing your job.
Good advice.
That's really all there is to it. But in a late night room, it's like if you can get the joke out as quick as humanly possible, then you're doing your job. Like, it's just, it's an interesting sort of shift. But it's so much more political, too, in a scripted room, I think.
Oh, yeah.
It's crazy.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, you want to be the favorite, and you're kind of in competition with your other writers, and, you know, you read their draft, and you go, oh, God.
The dreaded writer's draft.
I know. Okay. So you also moonlight by doing podcasts still and, you know, co-hosting the podcast with Kevin Smith, which is how I first got a chance to meet you. Mm-hmm. And then you go off and you do the Star Trek after show.
Yeah.
How did that come about? They do that in New York,
they do,
right?
They do that.
So you have to like commute to New York.
Every weekend.
Every
every weekend. We would shoot on Sunday nights. So my week would be essentially, I didn't miss a second of the Goldbergs writer's room either.
Right.
Friday night, I would have a red eye. And I would leave the room Friday night. My flight would be at 8:30, 9 o'clock. So most nights, I was leaving the room on time. Some nights, I was like, sorry, guys.
Yeah.
Good luck. I'm going. So I would fly on the red eye. Saturday, I would get to New York. Saturday morning, I'd get to the hotel, sort of check in on the script for the Sunday
yeah,
show.
Yeah, it kind of helps to like sort of know.
Yeah, know where we're going.
Where are you going?
What episode right. we're talking about, all that right. stuff. And then Sunday I'd go in during the day and we would read with the producers. We would talk about the pre-interview they've done with all of the actors or writers that we were going to have on the show. And we would shoot. We would go live at 9 p.m. East Coast time. And I would do the show, get out of my suit, go back to the hotel, and... You know, we'd do a live show. So I wouldn't get back to the hotel at 11. Maybe 11 o'clock, 11:30, I'm back at the hotel. And it's like, I've just done a live show.
So
I
you're
can't
up.
Go to sleep.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
like,
no, the adrenaline is
what
pumping.
Am I doing?
Yeah, right.
And then every Sunday night, I would just walk from my hotel in Soho. I'd walk into the Village and I'd go get a slice of pizza, walk back, maybe like just keep walking. I would, so many times, I would get so many steps in New York, like 20,000, 30,000 steps. And at 4 a.m., the car would come to take me to the airport on Monday morning in New York. So
right.
4 a.m., I get in the car, go to the plane, get into my seat, put the mask over my eyes, go to sleep. Land at LAX at 8:50 a.m., and I have just enough time to get coffee at Starbucks and get to the writer's room at Sony Monday morning.
Wow.
And then
no, they fly you first class at least?
Yes, thank
oh,
God.
Okay.
I told him, I was like, if you actually want me to be a human being on this show, I need to sleep. I need to sleep.
How did you get that job? Are you a huge Trekkie fan?
I am. You know, I always have been. I've just been a huge Star Trek fan my whole life through my mother. And we always sort of joked about it on Nerdist, and I would interview. I used to do this show called Attack of the Show on G4, which is a network that no longer exists. And on that show, I ended up, after Kevin, our host, left, I ended up sort of hosting a couple of weeks of the show and, like, doing interviews. And I had started as the gadget guy. I would do the gadget reviews on the show.
Uh-huh.
And then I ended up, by the end of it, I was hosting the show. But we would have on some of the Star Trek people on when they were promoting the Blu-rays for the Next Generation
okay.
coming out, mm-hmm. and I would interview them, and it was just so much fun for me. And they all seemed to enjoy me as a person. And those were the interviews that the people, the Embassy Row people that were and CBS that they saw, and they were like, "Oh, maybe maybe this guy.
Yeah,
maybe
get this guy.
Maybe this guy. He's in front of a television. He wears a tie." But this is the only job I've ever called my agent and said to him, yeah, my manager, I was like, there's going to be an after show for this Star Trek. Find out who's doing it and put my name in their head. Like, what do I need to do this job? I'm so ready to do this job.
Right.
And they went to work. And meanwhile, the EP of The Talking Dead, the show Hardwick does.
Right.
She listened to the IVF podcast and knew me from that, knew I love Star Trek from that.
You build your own momentum, don't
it
you?
It was insane.
Yeah.
And she's like, let's meet. Let's go talk about the show. I want you to, like, do something. And I thought I was going in to, like, consult. I was like, oh, I'll go be a consulting producer for this after show.
Uh-huh.
And then when I left that meeting, she was like, so start thinking about writers who know your voice. And I was like, "What? Oh, okay. And very late in the game. So this whole process was going on for July to probably the end of September when Star Trek Discovery premiered. It was like constantly like, who's doing the show? Am I doing the show? Is it still alive? I would call my agent. And finally, I was driving to work the show was going to premiere the next weekend, and it was a Tuesday. And I was driving into the Goldbergs. I was cutting through Cheviot Hills to get to Sony. And my phone rings, and I look. I'm like, oh, it's my agent. I pick up the phone, and they're like, hey, so we don't know what's happening still, but they want you to go to the premiere of Discovery at the Arclight tonight. And I'm like, what? I'm driving to work. I don't have a suit. I don't know if I'm doing this job. I'm like, I guess I could go home and get a suit, but I have to go write the Goldbergs. I'm like, I can't. They're like, you should just do this. So it wasn't until, we went to that premiere on Tuesday. Still didn't know if I was hosting the show. No one would tell me anything.
Uh-huh.
And then finally on Wednesday, we get the call that, yes, they'd like to offer you the show. I'm like, okay, then I have to find an entertainment lawyer to do that deal. And then I wind up, they're like, you're flying out Thursday, the next day, and the show starts Sunday. So I was like, okay. And I had told Adam F. Goldberg about this possibility of this thing. And he, being the nerd that he is, was like, oh, you have to do this. He's like, whatever it takes.
Good for
him. He's like, you have to go do this dumb after show. Yeah. And, you know, when I got the call, I was like, I went into the office. I was like, listen, it shoots on Sundays in New York. I will be here Monday through Friday. I just need this Thursday and Friday off. And he's like, go. He's like, go. It's fine. Go. And he let me go, and I went, and they had to work out, like, this crazy thing with Sony, because my contract with the Goldbergs was very specific about some things, and then Embassy Row turns out is owned by Sony, so that was a little easier than we thought.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And then the only other thing we had to work out was I host a talk show also on Legendary's digital platform called Project Alpha. It's called Sidekick with Matt Myra. I host that show. And in that contract, it says that I cannot do any other SVOD content. And so I called them, and I was like, guys, it's Star Trek. And they were like, we understand. So they let me, they also let me do it.
Good deal.
It was amazing. Everyone was like pushing me off to Star Trek. They're like, go, we know, live your dream. Go, young man. Talk about Star Trek for a living. And I did it, and it was 15 of the hardest weeks of my life because it was 7 days a week of working, and it was flying across the country every single weekend.
Yeah.
And
you wonder why you don't have a kid yet. So final question, with all of these various projects that you have going,
mm-hmm.
where do you see yourself in 5 years? What do you ultimately want to do? Do you still want to be a showrunner? Like I said, do you want to be Conan O'Brien? Do you want to be a performer? What ultimately do you want to do?
That's an excellent question. And this is a question that my wife has asked me many times, and my agent and manager ask me all the time. And I want, in my heart, I want to write, but I feel like the rest of the world is pulling me into the hosting thing.
Okay.
And I'm just trying to reconcile both of those things. What I want to do in 5 years, I'd like to have a show on the air that I created.
Okay.
Meanwhile, I would like to still be doing After Trek, and I would like it to be shooting in Los Angeles. That's what I'd like. I'd like to be talking about season 6 of Star Trek Discovery whilst during the week running a show that I created.
Okay. And hosting the Oscars. Matt, thank you very much for actually finding some time to do this.
Oh, Ken, appreciate it. Was a pleasure. You caught me during a hiatus.
Matt Myra, the hardest working man in show business. Wow. Thanks so much to Matt for being my guest. Also thanks to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, to John Wolfert, Howard Hoffman, and Randy Thomas. You can follow me on Twitter at Ken Levine, and you can email me anytime at HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. Again, that is HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. Come back next week. I am going to do a commentary track on a Frasier episode that I directed. That is next week on Hollywood and Levine. Thanks so much for listening this week. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.